Welcome back to another one of the short chats about the clinical academic track here at the University of St Andrews. I'm your guide through these, Dr Daniel Underwood, and joining me today is Dr Sarah Mills. Sarah, how are you this morning? It is still morning just about.
Yes, good, thanks.
Good. So tell everyone, who is Dr Sarah Mills?
So I am a senior lecturer at the School of Medicine and an academic GP, and I do research and teaching at the university 3 days a week, and I'm a GP partner for 2 days a week over at Bank Street Medical Practice in Cooper.
Mm. So how did you get into being a clinical academic? I presume you went to med school, decided that GP was where you wanted, and then somehow papers started to appear in your life.
Kind of, yeah. So I'm from a really strong teaching background. So my parents are teachers. My grandparents were teachers as well. You know, it's been something that always grew up sort of with the value of education. When I was in undergrad at St Andrews, after one of the first lectures that we had, Dr. Margaret Ritchie, one of the lecturers then said, if you're interested in teaching and research, stay behind after and have a chat. And there were four of us that stayed behind afterwards. And that was back when you used to have an inter-semester break in January, so you'd come back and sit exams after Christmas and then have 3 random weeks of doing nothing. And she had a bit of funding to have students come and take samples and label samples and do blood pressure checks and things like that on patients that she was doing a study with, which sounded cool, and I had nothing else to do for 3 weeks, so I said yes. And actually all the people that that work with her then have all gone on to have academic careers, which has been really interesting to watch over the years. So that was sort of a first taste and interest of that. And then she came back just a few minutes later and said, actually, I found some funding to send you to a medical student conference if you want to go. And we all thought that sounded really cool. So we went to Leiden, to the Leiden International Medical Student Conference. And we did a learning exchange to Germany with some of the people that we met there. And again, she found funding for this, which was incredible because I would never have been able to pay for it myself. And I really liked it. And then decided on general practice as a clinical specialty because for me, it felt like real medicine. It felt like where you can make a real difference to people. And I liked the continuity and the variety that you had in it and the independence. So that was sort of me very much sold on general practice, and sold on academia as well, and, decided to pursue both, which was good. And actually has been a fantastic career.
Now, good. How do you, because I've doing all of these short little interviews, time management seems to be something that comes up every time. How do you juggle basically having two jobs?
It's never easy. And certainly I think if you think of it as two jobs, it's always going to be challenging. I mean, for me, I sort of do it more on a task-based end of things. So I try to roughly have themes for what I'm doing on each of the days. So on Mondays and Tuesdays, I tend to be clinical, but equally, if there's a really important academic meeting I have to fit in or a government meeting or, you know, something like that, I will try to do that across lunchtime and just beg mercy from my colleagues. And equally, you know, if something clinical comes up on an academic day, I sometimes have to pinch hit and do that. But it's about give and take across both, trying to not drop the ball on things where the ball breaks as opposed to bounces, you know, and just sort of keep track of deadlines and things in that respect. I use a lot of sort of planning software to try to make sure that doesn't happen. But it's the sort of thing where in general practice and in academia, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. So trying to use yes and no strategically and importantly, but also, you know, playing to your strengths and playing to things that you're good at, you know, makes it more of a joy than a tool.
I think as someone that spends their entire life in the lab, my calendar is entirely up to me. But how flexible are like GP practices with, like you say, oh, I need to go to this academic meeting today, but obviously me and my cell line, it's just the two of us having fun together, whereas you are outward facing.
It is challenging. And the thing is, it is people facing. So we had, it always relies on the grace and favor of colleagues. And it's about giving as well as taking. So on days where you can, you know, say to somebody, I'll finish up the duty doc list, you can head home early, do it. We had one day back in September last year where there was a tier two panel meeting for permission for a data set that I've been applying for 3 years. And we got given 10 days notice and it was on a Tuesday morning. And I had to be there. And I was the only person that could be there from our group. And so I said, look, I'm doing home visits, but I will do my best. I mean, it was an art by the end of it. The practice manager had my laptop logged in. We had an emergency home visit that I had to literally just dash out to and take emergency drugs to somebody and get that set up and get them stabilized. I phoned ahead and said, I'm coming back in. It was absolutely down to the wire, but I managed to throw myself at my desk about 2 minutes before that meeting started. And you make it happen. There are other times where it doesn't work and you have to give genuine apologies and you know, hope that the rest of your track record bears you out on stuff.
No, I think that fits perfectly into where the conversation is going to go now, which is every career has its highs and lows. What are the best and worst things about being a clinical academic?
I mean, for me, it's really wonderful because it's a career on two scales. You know, it's when I'm at somebody's bedside, it has so much meaning and value. You know, I love being a doctor. I'm not an academic because I dislike clinical medicine. I love clinical medicine and I'm an academic because I couldn't fix everything at the bedside. You know, if I was standing in a consultation and I had everything I needed and I could do everything for that patient and give them the best possible care that they deserved and care that I was proud of and would want for me and my family, I would never have done any research because it wouldn't have been necessary, you know? And I'm doing the research because there were situations that I was in clinically where I thought, actually, this is not right. This is not good enough. This is not fair. And I can't fix this at the bedside. And it's then being able to take that step back and say, actually, let's go way far upstream. Let's look at the policy. Let's look at the service design. Let's look at actually how we approach things so that we're not at a bedside with nothing but our goodwill and a stethoscope, trying to fix some problems that could have been sorted out months or even years earlier. And that for me has a huge amount of meaning, you know, but equally, if I wasn't at the bedside for those times, my academic work wouldn't have the same impact. I look at large health data sets, and when I look at the data sets, I see the people behind them. I don't see a list of random variables or spherical chickens in a vacuum or tins of soup or whatever else you can collect data on. I see the stories and the people, and that for me gives a huge amount of meaning, you know, because, and a lot of academic stuff is doing it silly late at night or silly early in the morning, you know, and I don't get up at 5 a.m. because I'm really enthusiastic about spreadsheets. I do it because I believe in the message of what we're creating and because it's important. You know?
Yes, no, absolutely. So you mentioned it briefly there. What is the research that you do?
So I do a lot of work looking at the last year of life and unscheduled care. So I do some unscheduled care that isn't related to last year of life and some last year of life that isn't related to unscheduled care, but sort of those are the two big intersecting foci of my work. Mostly looking at health data science, but we also have some fantastic qualitative streams looking at patient lived experience and carers and clinicians' experiences. And really it's trying to do a better job of identifying more people who are in their last year of life and doing it sooner so that you're telling them, you know, months before they die as opposed to days, and so that you can put things in place in a better way so people have less care that is of low value to them, you know, care that doesn't align with their priorities and that doesn't actually make them better, but that just takes time away from them and is costly to them in terms of short-lived time and costly to the system in terms of being expensive and resource-consuming care that then doesn't align with what patients wanted. So it's about trying to make that better for people at the end.
Mm. And how do you try and incorporate that at the bedside? Is there an avenue for that in your career?
I mean, certainly one of the interesting things we've been doing is looking at risk prediction modeling. So looking at, can we identify people earlier? And I've certainly started noticing in my clinical work that some of the things that we found as variables in our risk prediction model I'm using. So for example, if someone has 3 clinical contacts with unscheduled care, they're much more likely to be in their last year of life than someone who hasn't had 3 clinical contacts in the sort of the set period of time. So it tends to be if I see a third out of hour sheet come through that I will proactively phone the patient and just check in on them as opposed to just saying, well, that's a third UTI. Let's file that. So it's interesting. It is give and take between different things, and you do get a sense of actually this could be significant in a way that wouldn't necessarily pop into my mind if I hadn't been doing the research and the things. And one of the nice things about the research is then we will publish this, and then it will go out, and it will not just be how do I change my clinical practice, but how does it become part of standard care for patients? You know, because actually if we can, you know, rather than just changing it in one consulting room in Cooper, can we change this across Scotland or across the UK? And that makes an enormous difference, and it's really exciting. It's worth,
you know, that's very exciting. No, absolutely. Even if it is 5 a.m. for spreadsheets.
It's not always 5 a.m. It's sometimes
sometimes it's 4 a.m.
It is give and take. So there are definitely times where it's crazy and definitely times where it's less crazy and you can make whatever you want of it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of change, education is always in a state of flux. And as you say, you have very interested in education. You have that family track record of education. How do you... There's the teaching aspect too. What is that like? How do you, how's medicine teaching?
I really love it. I mean, I'm very spoiled because I could very happily be a medical educationist. I could very happily be a medical researcher. I could very happily be a clinician and do all three of those things 100% of my time and still really enjoy it. I really enjoy the teaching that I do and would happily do more teaching. At the minute that because I've been, you know, I've had a number of research grants come through, I've had to focus a lot more on the research end of things. But I particularly enjoy the teaching I do on disability and society, which is something that I care very much about. And it's lovely to watch the students as they go through, you know, and to see them when they first start and then when they finish with us and go on to their clinical work. And it's been lovely to have ones that have kept in touch after graduation.
Good, lovely. And as we finish up this little informal chat, you've been a clinical academic for a while now. You've got all these expertise on all these fields. What are your top tips for any future clinical academics?
So I think certainly for me, don't let anyone tell you can't be an academic in primary care. Certainly, especially when I was starting out, people would say, oh, but you know, you really have to be in secondary care if you want to be an academic. Academic general practice is fantastic. I mean, I have a career that is the envy of most of my peers in terms of the flexibility, autonomy and control that I have over it, and also the joy that I get in doing the different things. I would say you can absolutely have a meaningful clinical commitment and a meaningful academic commitment. And I think a lot of people are worried about, you know, trying to get the balance right in that. And certainly I would say go for opportunities and try to meet as many people as possible and go in as many places as you can, because you actually have no idea where those different paths will take you. And a lot of the most exciting things that I've done with my career have been through people I've met and contacts I've had and, you know, adventures I've gone on, as opposed to just sort of sitting and trying to work hard at a desk. So, yeah.
And I think it certainly helps that you love everything that you do.
Yeah.
And on that very positive note, thank you, Dr. Sarah Mills, for this little chat, and thank you out there for listening.